So the first question is, dear Venerable, the world drives us to be goal-oriented and ambitious. If you are inherently a content person and not very ambitious, does that make you a lazy person? No. If I can put it in layman terms, anyone who is interested in following the Buddhist teaching, who is interested in knowing the Buddhist teaching and practice accordingly, we don't call it a Buddhist, this is too stereotyping and labeling. Whereas anybody such like that, if he is following the Buddhist teaching, he's the most ambitious person. You know why? He's the most ambitious not only to make this life happy, he's the most ambitious to elevate it to a higher level in even the next life. Have you ever come across, usually, an ambitious businessman who say, I want to do good business in my next life? He doesn't really care about the next life. But the Buddha's teaching follower, care, is so ambitious that he wants to be better even in the next life. He's so ambitious that he wants to get out from suffering. You won't be a lazy person by following a Buddha's teaching. You have to be very hardworking. You know how we monks and nuns work? We wake up 4:30 in the morning. We have our morning lesson at 5 o'clock. We have our breakfast 6:30. And we have lunch 11:30. And usually we don't take a dinner, no dinner. And ascetic monk, they only take one meal per day. We took two. If we really on that particular day, if we really have been laboring ourselves, we spend a lot of energy, we may take the exception of eating some congee or something like that. Other than that, we don't have a Sunday break. We work 7 days per week. We're never lazy. And there's another question that comes up at the end. How can you become a monk and a nun? Think about it. Can you be hardworking? If you are a lazy person, you don't want to be a monk and nun, because we really work hard. We really work hard in our spiritual odyssey. We pursue a way that is an elevation of life. We're not interested in materialism. We're not interested in looking for fame, reputation, wealth, and money, relationship. We're not interested in that. We're interested in ultimate emancipation from the slavery of our own desires. You want to fight the cocoon of desires and fly it away. We have been throwing threads to cocoon ourselves. Nobody else cocoon ourselves. You know a cocoon? We throw out a thread and bind us. And now we want to bite out a hole and get out. That's not easy. If you are goal-oriented, that is exactly what a Buddha follower is doing. Every session of meditation will have a goal. Today I'm meditating, I want to start now. I want to concentrate. I want to have a good session of meditation. I want to have samadhi. Not just a goal for every week, a goal for every day, a goal for every hour. So we're extremely goal-oriented. There's certain daily objective we want to achieve, a weekly objective we want to achieve, a life objective we want to achieve. We're always actively working. If we're not working at bettering ourselves, improving ourselves in meditation, we're working to contribute. We open the temple to the public. We want to make sure that the public enjoy the fruits of the architecture, the fruits of the spiritual pursuit. We want everybody to come, no matter your creed, your religion, your race, your color, your interest. We don't charge a fee. Even the lunch is free. It's only those who are faithful devotees who donate to make this happen. We need donations to make this happen. But we never say, everybody need to donate something. No. But we know the more you give, the more you get in return. Always giving, giving, giving. The first lesson to learn is to give. Not just money. When I was at the University of Toronto studying for my first year, I've been visiting a temple, Chan San Temple. It still exists, the Chan San Temple in Toronto. And as a poor student, I didn't have any money to donate. I went to that temple every Saturday, meditation, early meditation. I got familiar with the two monks in there. Those were the two monks who first came to Canada, because they came to visit the expo in 1967. You know there was an expo in 1967 in Canada? They came to join the expo, and they didn't return back to their own country. And they became the first two monks trying to bring the flag of the Buddha and put it on the hill of Canada to let it fly. And since then, a lot of people come. I actually lived in that temple for a year in my first year. I was living in the basement and they were living upstairs. And every day I went to school and I traveled back and I lived with them. That's how I got my chanting, how I learned my chanting, how I learned. I became their first translator. That's the reason why I could translate the Buddha Sutras. I became the first translators. And every Saturday we have meditation sessions. We have people from all walks of life. We have bus drivers, we have nurses, we have teachers, we have workers, we have all walks of life coming to meditate. Not many people though. A group of 20 people, not like us, we have a group of 60, 50, they only have a group of 20 people. But they brought their own food. So I still remember the Italian couple every week, they brought the best linguine, vegetarian meat sauce, I still remember. So everybody brought their own, somebody brought a salad and some apple pie, oh, the best apple pie, a British lady. I forgot her name, Janice or something like that. And so we have happy time. So they don't need a cook. Everybody brought a dish, and they were so happy. So I was in that surrounding for a year. I lived in the basement. I thought to myself, I saw all these people donating money. I said, I didn't have any money to donate. What would I do? Then I come to think about it. I said, donation does not need money. Why do I make a wish? So in front of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, I make a wish silently at night in the basement. And I said, I don't have money to give donations, but I want to bring 100 people to this temple so that they know about the Buddhist teaching. I don't need money to do that, right? So I start to write a diary for myself. I have a list. So for every person I brought to the temple, I write down his name or her name. And after 1 year, I really fulfilled the wish of bringing 100 people. What are the results for these 100 people? I don't know, but I know one case. I brought a Mrs. Wang, because Mrs. Wang, she was at that time about 65 years old, and she couldn't get along with the daughter-in-law. So they had a lot of, you know, argues, and she was not happy because the daughter-in-law could not, you know, they don't coordinate well. So the son said, I know his son, the son, do you have any place that my mom can go to spend some evenings or some Sundays and some Saturdays? I said, oh, I come to the temple. So I actually went to her house and brought her to the temple. And since then, every Saturday, Sunday, she's been visiting the temple. And so in 1980, I came over to Vancouver. I forgot about her. But after a few years, I think at the age of about 89 or 92, 91, I heard that she passed away on the first day of the Chinese New Year in the temple. He was just sitting on a sofa, and all these people were circumambulating, chanting, Namu Amitofo. And in the midst of the chanting, she passed away. No suffering, no pain. At the age of 92, she just passed away. So there was one case I learned about. That's the Mrs. Wang that I brought to the temple. So I actually brought 100 people to the two reference to listen to their lectures, and I didn't spend any money at all. I didn't have any money. So you can donate in kind. You don't need any money. It's an easy thing to do. There's a lot of efforts to do it. So I can say the follower of the Buddha's teaching is ambitious, extremely ambitious, extremely goal-oriented, yet he's content because he has no attachment. He has no attachment to wealth, to fame, to reputation. He does not build a big ego where he's selfish and egoistic. He's learning and learning more and more to be altruistic, to care, to give compassion, to give. He's hardworking, yet he's content inside. That's the different kind of content than the person who's looking for material. There's a content in a contentment, I can't use that word, in heart, in the heart, not in the face, not in sensual pleasures. Okay, next question. Buddhism is not idol worshipping, then why such big statues in a temple? Thank you for teaching the Wisdom Sutras. Buddhism is not idol worshipping. But you need an idol to bring to the attention of people. It's just like humans need words. But words is just tools. Language is just a tool. If you don't have a language, how can you even talk? Talking comes from thinking, right? Talking, you can't talk without thinking, right? You must have a mind to think. Talking comes from thinking. Thinking comes from language and conceptualization. If you do not have a language, how can you talk? The idol is only a means. That's not an end. That's not idolizing. You won't classify as you idolizing your language. But how come you depend on your language? Are you idolizing your Nanaimo ship to Sunshine Coast? Are you idolizing that? We need the boat, the ship to Sunshine Coast. It's a means. But you say, how can you? You don't need the ship. How can you? You don't need the ship. You swim there? How can you swim the Sunshine Coast? You need the ship, but you abandon ship when you get to Sunshine Coast. You abandon the idol. Throw away the idol. It's just a means to get you the attention. It's just a means, just like a language, to arouse your consciousness in it. Don't attach to it. When I look at an idol, I think about compassion. When you look at an idol, you think, it's wood. How come you're idolizing? How come you're worshiping? We don't think in the same terms. The way I look at an idol is different from the way you look at it. You look at it with discernment. You look at it with ups and downs and yes or no, good or bad. I look at it as one equality. You can also raise the question, how come the idol looks like a Chinese and not a Caucasian? I can tell you, the first idol of the Buddha is like a Roman statue. Aquiline nose, wide forehead, Greek. The first idol of the Buddha is a Greek statue. You take a look at anthropology. Buddhism spread to Rome first, to Italy. But at that time, Socrates, Aristotle's was so prevalent that they didn't receive it, so Buddhism went to the East. That's it for now. Next. What are the five contemplations? Here we've got the five contemplations. Well, it takes a long time to explain the five contemplations. And as a matter of fact, we should have translation on the five contemplations. Next time, we should translate the five contemplations so that you don't have to ask. When we're eating, we contemplate on five things. The first contemplation is, the food is in front of you. The first contemplation is, am I worthy of this eating? Am I worthy of the food? Is my practice good enough to be worthy of the food? Is my morality good enough to be worthy of some people's donating this food to me? That's what the monk should do. If I'm a monk, okay, the food put in here, okay, let's eat it. I don't want this, I don't want that. This is too tasty, it's too salty, too spicy. No. You should say, am I worthy of this offering? And where does this food come from? Comes from the kitchen prepare it. They work hard at it, the farmers farm, the farmers produce these crops, and then the donors buy them. There's a lot of work involved in it. I shouldn't waste anything, because there's a lot of work, there's a lot of devotees who devote to it. That's the first contemplation. There's five, but this is one of them. And considering the fact that I go to another session, so we'll talk about the five contemplations. In other words, the five contemplations remind you to be careful in your practice, to be hardworking in your practice, to be goal-oriented in your practice, to be ambitious in your practice. Next question, what is meant by wan fa wei xin? Everything originates from the mind. Wan fa wei xin, that means everything originates from the mind. Isn't everything originates from the mind? All your speech, your thought originates from the mind. Your speech originates from the mind. The action originates from the mind. We all know that. But how? How does it originate from the mind? How does it change course? Is it the right origination? Where is the mind? What happened to the mind? Can you trace that origination to the final performance? What is the process in the origination, in the preparation, in the conditions, in the final performance? In everything, there is the origination, the preparation, the conditions, and the final performance. So there's a lot of analysis in origination of a mental thought. That's what a very detailed school of thought in Buddhism, and we call it Vijnanamatrata, the study of the consciousness of the mind. There is thousands of volumes. Vijnanamatrata is the study of the mind. And interesting enough, most universities, Asian studies, have a few courses on consciousness. And this school of thought contains the most English translations. Get into it. Many, many professors, scholars, get into that psychology and philosophy. A lot of PhD thesis. And I talk about the eight consciousnesses. And as a matter of fact, I already show you about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness. The eight consciousnesses, those are the basic foundation. If you try to get into Vijnanamatrata, you're already equipped. If you have been listening to me very carefully on my lectures, you are prepared to read consciousness, school of thought. Because you know mano consciousness, you know manas consciousness, you know alaya consciousness. You know what mano is? Who is the mano? He's the manager. He's the manager who controls the salesman, the ear, the nose, the eyes, the taste, the body. We always say, the mano is very, very powerful. And there's also the manas consciousness, who are the directors, the shareholders. Maybe next time we'll go into detail. What is Pratyeka Buddha? Pratyeka Buddhas are those practitioners who live not in the time of the Buddha, who live not in the time that when there was Buddhism in this world. They don't even have a single book of Buddhism. Right now we have hundreds and thousands of volumes and tapes and all that whatnot in the internet, in library about Buddhism. But there are individuals in some eons of time where they didn't have any Buddha's teaching. And they still become the Buddha. Why? Because they watch, they observe. They watch spring, summer, autumn, winter. They watch, they meditate on the changeability of nature. And they realize impermanence. In other words, he gained his wisdom by meditating on environments. The bird song, the flowing of the stream, the ripples of the waves, seagulls. Nature can get you to become the Buddha. It's easier for practitioners of the Buddhist teaching who love nature to get enlightened. If you don't love nature, if you don't like nature, you like what? Wealth, boats, houses, cars, clothes, fashion design. Those are not the kind of people who get easily enlightened. Those who love nature, trail walk, hiking, even kayaking, even, I don't know. Do you love nature? Who hate nature? Nobody, right?